Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is another episode of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And this is going to be episode 325. And this podcast is going to be a super, super, super high yield podcast. I imagine that this is probably going to be a podcast kind of like episode 37. So this is an updated screening guidelines podcast. It's going to cover pretty much all the screening guidelines you need to know for your exams. I'll be really surprised if you got a screening guideline question wrong if you master this podcast. I'm basically going to talk about every category that the MBME cares about. And then two quick announcements. The first one is many of us know that, many of you listen to this podcast, you know, I'm a Christian. You know, I put these life lessons podcasts at the end of, you know, some of my podcasts. And, you know, I've gotten tons and tons of emails from people that have said that they found those life lessons to be beneficial. So I did actually start another website, divineinterventionlifelessons.com. And basically, you know, it's a lot of Bible-based teaching, just very short podcasts. They're basically like a bunch of life lessons. Pretty much all of them are going to be 10 minutes or less. Right now, I actually have six episodes, and I plan to keep adding more and more as time goes on. Although, you know, every now and then I'll also slot in a few life lessons at the end of these podcasts. But again, I've kind of started another website for that. And even those podcasts, the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcasts, you can actually find them on Apple Podcasts as well. They're actually right now on Apple Podcasts. That's one. And then the second announcement I want to make is if you're studying for Step 2 CK Step 3 or Complex Level 2 and 3, I do have a course starting next week. I have a test taking strategies course next week, Wednesday, from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And then I have a very comprehensive review course taking place on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday of next week. And basically, we're going to be covering peds, surgery, OB-GYN, IM, neuro, psych, ethics, biostats, healthcare systems, professionalism, communications, basically like the things covered on the USMLE exams, I am going to cover them in that course. Again, the course, I kind of like where it is right now. It's very comprehensive to these parts of the exam. And in addition to that, I try to keep the course updated very frequently so that because sometimes it's almost like you're in an arms race with the MBME and just want to make sure that you're up to date on everything. So we'll basically cover about 1700 scenarios across those 3 days that buttress those facts. There are multiple kinds of questions we use. We use multiple choice, audience response, freestanding questions, vignettes, scenarios. By the end, you'll feel very prepared. And again, hundreds of people have taken these courses and I've had people do really well. I've had people get 250s, 260s, 270s from people doing these courses. I've seen many people have very good score improvements between comparing their scores before they took the course and after they took the course. So let's go ahead and get right into these screening guidelines. So the thing is, these screening guidelines, to be honest with you, I'm going to put them in 7 categories. I think it's better to group them like this. If you're able to group them like this, then it's much easier to memorize. So unfortunately, this podcast is something that will be good Anki material. So listen to the podcast, because the thing is, I'll try to make some integrations along the way that will make it a little easier to remember. I'll give you some context. But again, I'll encourage you to either take your notes and go over it over and over and over again, or make your own Anki cards and then go over it over and over and over again. The thing is, this stuff is very important. You don't have to believe me, but just check pretty much people that have taken the exam recently. They have tons and tons of questions on these screening guidelines, right? Like they've started putting just more questions on these screening guidelines. So I'm really going to hit those hard. So the first category of people I will discuss are people that are pregnant, right? So there are some high yield things your friends at the MBME need you to know about screening guidelines in people that are pregnant, right? So the first one for people that are pregnant are, you know, gestational diabetes, right? Gestational diabetes is something we worry about in pregnant women. You're going to start screening at around 24 weeks, okay? You're going to start screening at around 24 weeks. And for the most part, you're going to do that with a 1 hour oral glucose tolerance test. And then if that is positive, you'll follow it up with a 3 hour oral glucose tolerance test. Now, another thing you check pregnant women for is HIV, right? So remember, HIV is something you check actually at the first prenatal visit. You check every pregnant woman for HIV at the first prenatal visit. Now, one thing that's actually high yield to know is that in addition to checking at the first prenatal visit, you have to retest for HIV in the third trimester. Again, because if you know a woman has HIV, you want to take certain measures so she doesn't transmit it to the fetus. You don't have vertical transmission to the fetus. And then Hep B is also the third thing you test for, you screen for in pregnant women is also Hep B, right? You test pregnant women for Hep B, and usually for the most part, start that at the first prenatal visit on NBM exams. And usually you're going to do that with the Hep B surface antigen. And then you also check for syphilis, right? You also check for syphilis at the first prenatal visit. That's important to know. And then another thing you also screen women for at the first prenatal visit is asymptomatic bacteriuria, right? So if you're a woman that has ever been pregnant and you go to the OB-GYN doctor, they're going to tell you to pee in a cup at your first prenatal visit, right? So they are checking you for asymptomatic bacteriuria, because remember, if you have asymptomatic bacteriuria, it increases your risk of preterm labor and delivery. So you're checked for that, right? Because remember, normal women that are not pregnant, non-pregnant women, if they have no symptoms but their urine contains bacteria, we don't treat. But for pregnant women, we make an exception. So if you don't have preterm labor and delivery, so we treat. So we screen at that first prenatal visit. If they have bacteria in their urine, we're going to treat it. We're going to treat it usually with nitrofurantoin. We're going to treat it with nitrofurantoin or, you know, one of those lower generation cephalosporins. And then after you treat it, you need to actually do a test of cure. You need to do a test of cure. And then another thing you also screen pregnant women for, so this is the sixth thing, is group B strep. You're going to screen for group B strep. Remember that strep E. galactiae. You're going to do that right between 35 to 37 weeks. You're going to figure out the woman's group B strep status. And then remember, a woman's Rh status, so determining if she's Rh positive or Rh negative, and also determining her antibody status, right? Remember, the antibody status is, obviously, for a woman, you check the Rh status, right? If it's positive or negative, right? And then the next thing you do, if a woman is Rh negative, right, she could potentially make antibodies. So you check her antibody status by doing the indirect, that's very high yield, the indirect Coombs test, right? That's something, again, you also do at the first prenatal visit. And remember, women get Rogam. If a woman is Rh negative, she gets Rogam at around 28 weeks gestation. And then she gets it within the first 3 days postpartum, the second dose of Rogam. So again, in pregnant women, don't forget to check for gestational diabetes. Don't forget to check for HIV. Don't forget to check for Hep B. Don't forget to check for syphilis. Don't forget to check for asymptomatic bacteriuria. Don't forget to check for group B strep, and don't forget to check for the Rh status. And remember, HIV is kind of unique. You're going to test for that twice during pregnancy. You're going to test for it at the first prenatal visit, and then you're going to repeat it in the third trimester. Okay, so that's category number one. That's category A, pregnant people. Now, category B are smokers, right? Again, these are just high-risk populations that you can just pretty much tell, I'm going to get a question on this stuff on my exam. So smokers, the first thing I want you to keep in mind with screening these people for first is a AAA, right? An abdominal aortic aneurysm. Remember, these people, the smokers that we screen for AAA, right? First, you need to be between the ages of 65 to 75. That's very high yield to know. You need to be between the ages of 65 to 75. And we only screen men. I'll just say this right now. You should never screen women for AAAs on NBM exams. You only screen men for AAAs on NBM exams, right? So it has to be a man, has to be between the ages of 65 to 75, and it must be a guy that has smoked in the past, right? He must be a guy that has smoked. If you've ever smoked as a guy, or if you're a non-smoker as a guy, but you have a family history of an abdominal aortic aneurysm, then yes, you do need to screen. Again, between the ages of 65 to 75. And remember, you do that with an ultrasound, and if you notice that the person's the abdominal aorta, the diameter is, you know, more than 5.5 centimeters, so 5.5 centimeters or higher, then those people need intervention, right? You need endovascular repair of some sort. And then one other thing you also screen for in smokers that's kind of unique is osteoporosis. Again, remember, we're screening women, right? So if a woman is on, because normally for osteoporosis, we screen starting at the age of 65 with a DEXA scan. But in smokers, you can actually start screening for osteoporosis if they are less than 65, right? Again, with a DEXA scan. And you also do this early, you know, less than 65 years old, osteoporosis screening in people that are just high risk, right? In general, those are people that are very thin, right? So let's say, for example, a woman has anorexia nervosa, you're going to screen her for osteoporosis. Or let's say a woman has premature ovarian failure, that's another very good candidate for less than 65 years old osteoporosis screen. And then the third thing you screen for in smokers is lung cancer, right? I'll say that again. You screen smokers for lung cancer. So what are the guidelines, right, for smokers with lung cancer? The big one I want you to keep in mind is if you need to first be between the ages of 55 to 80, that's a very important one, between the ages of 55 to 80, and you must meet certain conditions, right? So the first, again, condition is again, you must be between 55 to 80, and then you must have more than, 30 or more pack years in terms of smoking history, right? 30 or more pack years in terms of smoking history. And you either have to currently be smoking or have quit at like less than 15 years ago, right? So let's say, for example, you have like a 30 pack year smoking history, but you quit 30 years ago, you're between 55 to 80, you're not eligible for lung cancer screening, right, as a smoker. So again, remember, you must have had more than a 30 pack or more year smoking history. That's one. Two, you must either still be currently smoking or quit less than 15 years ago. And then three, you need to be between the ages of 55 to 80. And how do you screen those people? You're going to screen those people with a low-dose CT scan. I'll say that again. You're going to screen those people with a low-dose CT scan, right? Again, between the ages of 55 to 80. And guess what? You only do that low-dose CT scan three times. If you notice that, and you do it every year, obviously, right? That's the screening interval. So if you do it every year three times and you notice that it's negative, then you can stop those low-dose CT scans in those people after that interval. So again, very, very high yield to know these screening guidelines, again, in smokers. Those are populations they love to test on exams. Now, so that's category number two, right? So for smokers, we said, again, we screen them for triple A's. We talked about their screening for osteoporosis. And then we also talked about their screening for lung cancer. Now, let's jump on to the next category. The next category of people are people that have special genetic diseases, right? So there are certain high yield screening guidelines to know if you have a certain genetic disease, right? So the first one is if a person has familial hypercholesterolemia, right? These are people that get MIs at 20, like very early MIs in life. Remember, most times when people have familial hypercholesterolemia, they usually have it because they have an LDL receptor mutation, right? They usually have an LDL receptor mutation, so they're not able to clear LDL from the circulation. Basically, those people, the easy way to remember the screening guidelines, right? Obviously, you're going to be checking the LDL cholesterol. The key thing I want you to remember is just remember the rule of related to three. The rule of related to three. What do I mean by that? Basically, those people, you start at the age of three. You check their LDL cholesterol at the age of 3 years. You check their LDL cholesterol at the age of 9 years, and then check their LDL cholesterol at the age of 18 years. So you check it at three, you check it at nine, and you check it at 18. And for the most part, you even after the age of 18, you're going to keep screening. But again, the NBA means they're not going to go into those murky waters on exams. Now, the second group of people with, like, again, like a special disease that you need to screen for, right, is inflammatory bowel disease. So if a person has inflammatory bowel disease, it doesn't matter which type, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, literally doesn't matter. Those people need to be screened for colon cancer, right? They need to be screened for colon cancer 8 years after you make the initial diagnosis of IBD. So once you're diagnosed, let's say you're diagnosed with inflammatory bowel disease in the year 2022, either ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, and hopefully you will not get that diagnosis, God willing. But let's say a person gets diagnosed in 2022, then you need to start screening them for colon cancer in the year 2030, right? In the year 2030. But there's a small exception to this rule, right? Where you actually need to start screening a little earlier. And this is actually if a person is diagnosed with primary sclerosing cholangitis. If a person is diagnosed with primary sclerosing cholangitis, you need to actually screen them for colon cancer at the time of diagnosis. That's very high yield. You need to start screening them for colon cancer at the time of diagnosis. And then you're going to continue screening them for colon cancer every 1 to 2 years afterwards. That's very important to know. So if a person has PSC at the time, not 8 years later, at the time of diagnosis, you need to start screening them for colon cancer. And they need to do it for, every 1 to 2 years afterwards. Now, The next special genetic disease is Lynch syndrome, right? HNPCC, hereditary non-polyposis, colorectal cancer. Remember, these people tend to have like microsatellite instability problems. So how do we screen these people for colon cancer? Well, remember, you're going to start screening these people for colon cancer at the age of 20, right? You need to start screening them at the age of 20. And you need to do it every 1 to 2 years. And many times, these high-risk colon cancer populations, you're just going to go straight to a colonoscopy. You're not going to be messing around with FIT tests, blah, 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 blah. No. Just go straight to colonoscopy for these people. But the thing is, unfortunately, Lynch syndrome causes many other problems besides colon cancer, right? And your friends at the NBME kind of care that you know some of these things. So the thing is, people that have Lynch syndrome, again, hereditary non-polyposis, colorectal cancer, those people need to be screened for endometrial cancer starting at around the age of 30. And you need to do it every 1 to 2 years. Many times you're going to do this screening with either an endometrial biopsy or endometrial sampling. Again, starting at the age of 30, and you do it every 1 to 2 years, right? So an easy way to remember which one comes first. Remember, C comes before E in the alphabet. So the C, the colon cancer, you start at age 20, right? And again, you do it every 1 to 2 years. And many times, those people, you also give them like prophylactic aspirin. Aspirin actually lowers a person's risk of getting colorectal cancer, especially in these people. And then again, the endometrial cancer, the E, starts at age 30. And again, it's every 1 to 2 years as well. And one thing I will just encourage you to keep in mind, because sometimes your friends at the NBME, they like you to know some prophylactic like surgeries and stuff you can do in people that have genetic disease, right? Many of us have heard of how like, oh, if a person has MEN2, of any sort, be it MEN2A or 2B, right? You're going to offer them a prophylactic thyroidectomy because it's not a matter of if they will develop medullary thyroid cancer. It's just a matter of when. If they live long enough, they will develop medullary thyroid cancer. Well, that same advice, in a sense, applies to people that have HNPCC. Those people, you actually need to offer them a prophylactic hysterectomy after childbearing, because again, their risk of endometrial cancer is astronomically high. Their risk of ovarian cancer is also astronomically high. So many times we offer these people a THBSO, right? So THBSO means a total abdominal hysterectomy and bilateral salpingo oophorectomy, right? So it's a surgery where you take out the woman's ovaries, her fallopian tubes, and her uterus. So we offer these to these people after childbearing. That's very high to know for exams. Now, the next special genetic disease I want to talk about is familial adenomatous polyposis, right? So FAP, right? FAP. Remember, FAP is an autosomal dominant disorder, right? It's a problem with the APC gene, right? So many times those people will have an APC gene mutation and that will give them all these polyps. And then after that APC gene mutation, they'll have a KRAS mutation. And then after that KRAS mutation, they'll have a P53 mutation. And then that will drive them towards colorectal cancer. So for those people, you need to start screening them for colon cancer at the age of 10 years. And you need to do it every year. I'll say that again. You need to screen them for colon cancer starting at the age of 10. And you need to do it every year. And then the final genetic group that I'm going to talk about are people that have BRCA mutations, right? People that have BRCA mutations. So the big thing I want to talk about with BRCA mutations is breast cancer. So what are the breast cancer screening guidelines for people with BRCA mutations? Remember, those people between the ages of 25 to 29, they deserve annual breast MRIs. I'll say that again. Between the ages of 25 to 29, you deserve an annual breast MRI if you have a BRCA mutation. But if you're over the age of 30, then you deserve annual breast MRIs plus mammograms. So every year, if you're over the age of 30 and you have a BRCA mutation, you need an annual breast MRI and an annual mammogram. Okay, so that's the third category of people that I wanted to discuss, right? So again, just to summarize, we talked about the screening guidelines for people that have familial hypercholesterolemia, for the people that have inflammatory bowel disease, for the people that have primary sclerosing cholangitis, for the people that have hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancer, for the people that have BRCA mutations, and for the people that have APC gene mutations, aka familial adenomatous polyposis. Now, the fourth category of people I want to discuss are people that are, I call them the risky sexual group, right? The risky sexual group, right? So what do I mean by, ooh, you're in the risky sexual group? Well, the risky sexual group are people that have HIV, men that have sex with men, IV drug users, sex workers, people in that group, right? Those are the risky sexual people. That's category D, right? So for those people, what are the screening guidelines for these people? Well, the first thing you want to be able to screen these people for is HIV, right? Basically, if you're in this high-risk category and you're between the ages of 15 to 64, you deserve annual HIV screening. That's very important to know for exams. Now, the second thing here is these people, if they have syphilis, I mean, you need to screen them for syphilis every 3 months. Again, these high-risk sexual individuals, you need to screen them for syphilis every 3 months. And then the third thing you want to screen these people for are chlamydia and gonorrhea. Because the thing is, for the most part, if you're less than 24, every female that is less than 24 years old is recommended that you screen them for chlamydia, gonorrhea. But the thing is, if you're over 24 and you're not high risk sexually, you don't need to be screened for chlamydia, gonorrhea, right? So the thing is, these people, because they are high risk, even over the age of 24, you're still going to screen them for chlamydia, gonorrhea. And remember, the only people you should screen on NBM exams for chlamydia and gonorrhea are women. Don't screen men for chlamydia or gonorrhea on NBM exams. And then the fourth thing you screen these people for is Hep B, right? Because again, remember, you can get Hep B through sexual intercourse, right? So these people, you screen them with the Hep B surface antigen every year. And also, this rule also applies to like an anti-vaxxer. Let's say a person is like, I don't want the Hep B vaccine. You can screen them with the Hep B surface antigen every year. So those are the people that fall into the high-risk sexual category, right? This is category number 4, category D, right? So again, we talked about the HIV guidelines in these people, the chlamydia gonorrhea guidelines in these people, the syphilis guidelines in these people, and the Hep B guidelines in these people, right? Now, the next group of people I'll talk about, the next category, this is category number 5, right? So these are metabolic diseases, right? Metabolic diseases. These ones are floridly high yield to know for exams, right? So the first one I'm going to talk about is hypertension, right? Hypertension. Remember, if a person is, you need to screen for hypertension. It's like very, very important on NBMEs, right? And you screen for hypertension starting at the age of 18, right? So between the ages of 18 to 40, you screen for hypertension every 3 to 5 years. But once you get over the age of 40, you screen for hypertension every 1 to 2 years. The reason we have a more frequent screening guideline if you get over the age of 40 is because obviously the incidence and the prevalence of hypertension is way higher over the age of 40 compared to the 18 to 40 age group. Although I suspect that this guideline will change in the future because just again with the burden of metabolic disease in this country, more and more people are getting like super hypertensive very early in life because and those things, you know, obviously will destroy a person's kidneys. Now, the next thing I want to discuss about in terms of screening is diabetes, right? So diabetes, right? So how do we screen for diabetes? Basically, the two groups of people who screen for diabetes just in general, first things first, are people that are obese on NBM exams. If a person is obese and they're between the ages of 40 to 70 years old, you need to screen them for diabetes every 6 months. And remember, there are many ways you can screen for diabetes. You can do the fasting blood glucose, which is 126 or higher, or you can do the, and again, I talked about this extensively in my diabetes podcasts. You can do the oral glucose tolerance test. You can do the hemoglobin A1C, right? There are many ways you can screen for diabetes, right? And then, so first group, if you're obese, between the ages of 40 to 70. Second group, if you have hypertension. If you have hypertension, right, basically if your blood pressure is over 135 systolic and 80 diastolic, then you're over the age of 45, you're 45 or higher, you also need diabetes screening again every 6 months, right? So for the most part, these high-risk groups that I just mentioned, again, obese person between the ages of 40 to 70, hypertensive person, so blood pressure over 135 over 80, over the age of 45, you need to be screening these people for diabetes every 6 months, right? And then osteoporosis, right? I kind of talked about it already, but you know, smokers, they have their special recommendation. But if you're over the age of 65 and you're a woman, we don't screen men for osteoporosis. You're a woman. We're going to screen you with a DEXA scan, right? And we're going to do, remember, we're looking for that T score. If your T score is less than negative 2.5, then that's diagnosed. If it's negative 2.5 or less, that tells us you have osteoporosis. You need to be placed on some kind of a bisphosphonate. And then the final metabolic disease I think I'll talk about is hyperlipidemia, right? So like LDL cholesterol, right? So the big thing I want you to keep in mind here is just really try to divide these people into three groups, right? There's the screening guidelines for men, there's the screening guidelines for women, and there's screening guidelines for diabetics. That's very important to know. So what's the screening guideline for men? Well, for men, basically there are three tiers of men. You can be between the ages of 20 to 45. For those people, we screen them every 5 years. for hyperlipidemia. Basically, everyone gets screened for hyperlipidemia starting at 20, if that's an easier thing for you to remember, right? But for men, again, between the ages of 20 to 45, we screen every 5 years. Now, if you're between the ages of 45 to 65, we're going to screen you every 1 to 2 years. Now, if you go over the age of 40, over the age of 65, then we need to screen you for hyperlipidemia every single year. Again, just as a general concept, for a metabolic disease, the screening guidelines get more frequent the older you become. Simple as that. So again, for men, from 20 to 45, every 5 years. From 45 to 65, every 1 to 2 years. Over the age of 65, every year. Now, for women, the guidelines are similar. But the thing is that starting at age 20, we expand the range a bit more. Because women, their risk of cardiovascular disease is not that high until they go past menopause, right around the age of 55. So the thing is, for women, between the ages of 20 to 55, we screen for hyperlipidemia every 5 years. But from 55 to 65, we do it every 1 to 2 years. And then over the age of 65, we're going to do it every year. Okay? We're going to do it every year. Now, if you're a diabetic, basically, I'll just tell you this. Do you have diabetes? Is your LDL cholesterol over... let me put it this way. We screen diabetics for hyperlipidemia every year. The end. We screen them for hyperlipidemia every year. And remember, if you notice that their LDL cholesterol is 70 or higher, that's in milligrams per deciliter, those people are going to be placed on a high-intensity statin, like atorvastatin or rosuvastatin. That's very important to know, right? So again, key metabolic diseases we talked about screening for, right? We talked about hypertension. We talked about osteoporosis. We talked about diabetes. And we talked about hyperlipidemia, right? So we should all know the screening guidelines for that. Now, we're almost done with this podcast, but the next group I want to talk about are cancers, right? Cancers. Very, very important to know, right? So the first one is colon cancer. Again, I've kind of talked about colon cancer in some genetic diseases, but let's talk about just like most, you know, pretty much everyone else, right? So the thing is, colon cancer, you start screening at the age of 50. Now, let me tell you this. On an MBM exam, you may see a person that is 45 or higher that needs colon cancer screening, right? The thing is, the guidelines have changed relatively recently to where we can start screening people at the age of 45. So that's something to keep in mind, right? So I would probably say that colon cancer screening should be done between the ages of 45 to 75. I'll say that again. It should probably be done between the ages of 45 to 75 on MBM exams. That's the screening interval. Now, the thing is, there are many different ways you can screen for colon cancer. And unfortunately, all these different ways are very high yield to know for exams, right? So you can do a colonoscopy every 10 years. That's perfectly fine. You can do flexible sigmoidoscopy every 5 years. That's perfectly fine. You can do flexible sigmoidoscopy every 10 years. But the thing is, if you're doing it every 10 years, you need to be doing a FIT test, like a fecal immunotest. You're supposed to do that every year if you're doing the FlexSig every 10 years. You can also do that FIT test, again, that fecal immunotest, or the FOBT, right? The fecal occult blood test, you know, those hemocults. You can do those every year as well, right? And then a new kid on the block that I suspect will gain wider spread acceptance in the future is CT colonography. You can do CT colonography, right? Basically, it's a CT scan that looks at your colon, but it has like certain protocols that make it very highly sensitive for detecting colon cancer. You're going to do that every 5 years, right? So again, just in summary, you screen people for colon cancer on MBM exams, you know, outside of those genetic diseases I've talked about earlier, between the ages of 45 to 75. And you're going to do that with colonoscopy every 10 years, or you can do flexible sigmoidoscopy every 5 years, or you can do flexible sigmoidoscopy every 10 years, but you need to do a FIT test, a fecal immunotest every year. Or you can do an FOBT, or that, again, fecal immunotest every year, or you can do CT colonography every 5 years. Now, let me tell you this. For all these other tests I've mentioned besides colonoscopy, if any of those things are positive for malignancy or show you something that looks like malignancy, your next best step in management on MBM exams is always going to be a colonoscopy with a biopsy. It's always going to be a colonoscopy with a biopsy, right? So that's the first one. Now, the second cancer I'll talk about is breast cancer, right? Remember, breast cancer, there are two guidelines that are used, right? There's the American Cancer Society guidelines that say start at 40 and screen every year in women. USPSTF says start at 50, do it between the ages of 50 to 75, and then do it every two years, right? So the thing is, many people use the USPSTF guidelines, but the thing is, our friends at the MBME also use the ECS guidelines. So I would know both if I were you. Many times they will give you enough context in the exam question that will help you pick out the right answer. ECS says pretty much start at 40, screen every year for as long as the woman has a decent life expectancy. USPSTF says between 50 to 75, do it every 2 years. That's obviously going to be with a mammogram. And then cervical cancer, right? So what are the screening guidelines for cervical cancer? These are actually like hot cakes for our friends at the MBMEs, right? So this one you definitely want to make sure you know and you know well. But basically, HPV, cervical cancer, you're going to screen between the ages of 21 to 29. Right? And you're going to do that with a pap smear every 3 years. Between the ages of 21 to 29, you do it a pap smear every 3 years. Now, if you're over the age of 30, right? So if you're between 30 and 65 years old, there's one of three modalities you can go with. There is a preferred modality of the three, but the other two are perfectly acceptable on MBM exams. So the preferred modality is that you do a pap smear and HPV co-testing every 5 years. So a pap smear plus HPV co-testing every 5 years. That is the preferred modality for people between the ages of 30 to 65 for cervical cancer. But between the ages of 30 to 65, some other options that are available to you is you can do a pap smear every 3 years, just like you did from 21 to 29. But again, it's not preferred. Alternatively, you can also do that HPV testing. You can test for the high-risk HPVs every 5 years if you're between the ages of 30 and 65. That's pretty much it, right? That's pretty much it in terms of those people. But then there are also, unfortunately, some other people that have, again, special cervical cancer screening guidelines. One is if you have HIV. If you have HIV, or let's say you've had, if you have some kind of immunodeficiency disease of some sort, those people, they actually get pap smears every year. That's very important to know. So if you have HIV or some kind of immunodeficiency disease, especially those T-cell immunodeficiency diseases, like the George, for example, you need pap smears every year. That's very important. Now, another thing that's also helpful to know is hysterectomies and pap smears, right? So the thing is, if a woman gets a hysterectomy for a benign reason, so let's say for a leiomyoma, for example, after that hysterectomy, do you still need to do pap smears? The answer to that is no. In those people, you don't have to do pap smears. But if a woman had a hysterectomy for a malignant reason, cervical cancer or endometrial cancer or endometrial hyperplasia, then those people, they still need pap smears. And you need to do those pap smears of the vaginal cuff. That's very high yield to know. You need to do those pap smears of the vaginal cuff in those people on MBME exams. And many times, if you do a hysterectomy because of cervical cancer, many times you're going to keep doing those pap smears in those people for at least 20 years after the surgery was done, 20 years after the hysterectomy was done. And then one other thing that I think is important, because again, I want to be very thorough with the screening guidelines. I essentially want you to listen to this podcast, know all the screening guidelines, and crush all these questions on exams. Remember I said that you can stop, you know, pap smears at the age of 65 for, you know, most women, right? Now, what are some things you want to keep in mind with stopping at 65? You stop at 65 when you meet two criteria. One, the person has no history of cervical cancer, right? Or they have no history of like a very severe pap smear result, like HSIL or CIN3 or, you know, like really bad dysplasia, right? And they must have had three negative pap smears in a row, right? They must have had three negative pap smears in a row. Or they must have had like, you know, two negative like paps plus HPV co-testing, right? So if you're just doing straight up pap smears, you must have had three negatives in a row. Or if you're doing pap smears and the HPV co-testing, which is the preferred method over the age of 30, then if you have two of those negative in a row and you're at 65, you can go ahead and stop pap smears in these people. You can go ahead and stop pap smears in these people. Now, the final category, category number 7, right? So again, just I guess to summarize what I've talked about already, right? For cancers, I talked about colon cancer screening guidelines. I talked about breast cancer screening guidelines. I talked about cervical cancer screening guidelines. Again, are there other guidelines beyond these? Yes, there are. But are they high yield to know for the exam? The answer to that question is pretty much no, right? But the screening guidelines you see me discuss in this podcast, they are important for you to know, for you to know for exams. And then the final group of people, category number 7, just some grab bag ones here. There's not much here. But basically, remembering kids, I guess the first thing I'll talk about here, kids, remember kids, if you notice that they're having any language difficulties, you need to screen their hearing. You need to check their hearing. Many times you're going to do that with audiometry. That's very important to know. And then remember, for all kids between the ages of 3 to 5 years old, you're going to screen them for amblyopia. Basically, like lazy eye, right? You're going to screen them for amblyopia once between the ages of 3 to 5 years old, right? And then remember, many times we, if you're less than 24 years old, everyone that is female, we screen them for gonorrhea and chlamydia, right? If you're less than 24 years old. Remember, if you're over 24 years old, we only do that gonorrhea chlamydia screening if you're high risk. And then some weird ones, because the thing is, remember, most times when people get Hep B, so that's the third one I'm going to discuss. Most people that get Hep B, many times they get it from blood transfusions. But remember, you don't only get it from blood transfusions. Again, if you're intimately working with blood, you can get Hep B, right? So if a person is doing a lot of dialysis, remember dialysis, you're literally like circulating these people's blood through like many different machines, right? Those people, they actually need Hep B screening every year, right? Or let's say a person is immunosuppressed. Let's say they're on like chemotherapy or like long-term chemotherapy or long-term immunosuppressive therapy because they are, you know, like post-transplant patients. Those people, again, need Hep B screening every year. They need Hep B screening every year with the Hep B surface antigen. And then remember, again, as I said, for gonorrhea chlamydia, we don't screen men for that on NBM exams. We screen only women, right? And then remember, Hep C, you deserve a one-time Hep C screening. Usually, if you're between everybody, between the ages of 18 to 79, between the ages of 18 to 79, you deserve a one-time Hep C screening, right? And then don't forget that we also screen people for depression with, you know, these fancy questionnaires, like the actually not fancy, they're easy questionnaires, like the PHQ-9 or the Beck's Depression Inventory, right? So those are the things you can use, right? So again, to summarize, the 7 categories of people we talked about in terms of screening today, category number 1 were people that were pregnant. We talked about gestational diabetes, HIV, Hep B, syphilis, asymptomatic bacteriuria, group B strep, right? RH status, right? And then category number 2, we talked about were smokers. For smokers, we talked about the triple E screening. We talked about osteoporosis screening, especially with them being less than 65. And then we talked about the lung cancer screening guidelines for smokers. And then for special genetic diseases, we talked about, that was category number 3. We talked about familial hypercholesterolemia. We talked about inflammatory bowel disease, talked about primary sclerosing cholangitis, talked about hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancer. That's a high-yield group to know for exams. We talked about the APC gene mutation in familial adenomatous polyposis. And then we talked about BRCA mutations. And then category number 4, we talked about the risky sexual folks, right? So there, we categorized like screening for HIV, screening for chlamydia gonorrhea, screening for syphilis, screening for Hep B. We talked about those people. And then category number 5, we talked about metabolic diseases. We talked about hypertension. We talked about osteoporosis. We talked about diabetes. And we talked about hyperlipidemia. And then for cancers, right, that was category number 6. We talked about colon cancer screening guidelines, breast cancer screening guidelines. We talked about cervical cancer screening guidelines. And we said quite a bit about cervical cancer screening guidelines and when you could stop. And then category number 7, we talked about just a grab bag, right? For the most part, we talked about like Hep B and C, talked about kids, talked about chlamydia and gonorrhea, right? And then we talked about depression. So again, please listen to this podcast over and over again if you need to. Find some way to commit the stuff to memory. But I feel like the way I've grouped it for you probably makes it a lot easier to remember. You just need to remember that, oh, there are 7 categories, right? And if you can kind of put these, you know, little things on under each one, then I think it'll be much, much easier to remember. So as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for step 1, step 2 CK, step 3. So if you're interested in that, shoot me an email through the website. Also, you know, if you need tutoring for preclinical med school exams, third year clerkship shelf exams, I do also offer one-on-one tutoring for those. And then I have the review courses for step 2 CK, step 3, complex level 2 and 3 as well. And then I also work with people on their ERAS applications, right? Again, I've been on an admissions committee before. I've worked with tons of people that have matched into very competitive specialties, anesthesia, dermatology, ENT, neurosurgery, orthopedic surgery. I've worked with tons of people that have matched into these categories. So if you have a tricky application and you need help with like personal statements, rec letters and stuff, or editing your ERAS application, just again, shoot me an email through the website. And I'll be happy to give you some more information. And then I have this podcast on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, and on Spotify. So if you subscribe to those podcast apps, you'll see the most recent 150 podcasts. The key thing I'll just say there is it's the most recent 150. So since this is episode 325, you'll see everything after episode 175, right? If you want everything from episode 1 all the way to 325, go to the website. It's a WordPress role. There's really no way to circumvent that role. And then I do also have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcast and Videos. That's where I put the videos that I make for the website. Although if you want the slides that are associated with those videos, again, go on the website itself. You'll find the slides that are associated with those videos. And then, as I also say, there's this notes feature. If you go on the website, there's this thing called episode notes, right? So the website, by the way, is Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S.com. So if you go there, there's an episode notes feature at the top. Basically, a lot of my step one material, a lot of my step two CK material has been transcribed. Again, I would encourage you to still listen to the podcast to get the understanding. And most times it just makes more sense to make your own notes. It makes it a lot easier to remember. But if you can't, again, there are many, many of my podcasts, especially for step two CK, step three, they have been transcribed on the website, broken up by sections, almost like a mini textbook in a sense. And then, by the way, I'll put in a plug-in for the DIP deck, the Divine Intervention Podcast deck. If you're starting out your third year rotations, that DIP deck contains, again, it's basically like a very awesome Anki deck made of a ton of my high-yield Step 2 CK material. So if that's something you're interested in, again, it's on Reddit. Just look for the DIP deck, find the most recent thread on it, and you should be able to download it. A very awesome medical student pretty much made that deck. It wasn't me that made it. And then finally, in terms of organization, if you're trying to figure out, oh, for this subject, what podcast should I study? On the website, go to the part that says exam topic lists is at the top. It's a header. Go to exam topic lists. If you click on it, it will take you to a Google spreadsheet that breaks things down by step one, step two, CK/step 3. And it tells you, oh, for internal medicine, these are the podcasts that are relevant. For the rapid review series, these are the podcasts that are relevant. Just stuff like that. So that's just for me what I found to be the easiest organization tool right now. If you subscribe to the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com, whenever I make a new podcast, you will get an email notification. So please listen to this podcast, commit this stuff to memory. I can pretty much promise you this podcast will make positive benefit for those that are taking step 2 CK or step 3 or complex level 2 or complex level 3. Even if you're studying for an internal medicine board exam, this podcast will be helpful. Again, pretty much every screening guideline you need to know, I have discussed in this podcast. And also if you're taking the internal medicine shelf or the family medicine shelf, this is definitely a podcast to also know. And also the early part of this podcast on pregnant women will be helpful for people that are taking an OB-GYN shelf. So thank you for listening. I wish you all the best. God bless you. Thank you.